Hello, I'm John McNamara, the Information Architect for Webs4MQ, and I'm sat here today with Maura Cusin, the Subject Matter Expert for Webs4MQ Security. Hello, Maura.
Hi, John.
Today we're going to talk about security for messaging, and we're going to translate that into what that means for Webs4MQ security. So we're going to have a chat at a fairly high level initially about security in general for messaging, and then try and break that down in terms of what it means for Webs4MQ. Does that sound okay for you, Morag?
Sounds good.
Brilliant. Okay. Okay, so Morag, the first question then is, what is security in terms of messaging?
Okay, I think when you think about security in messaging, you probably break it down into a number of points. And each of these different areas has a big long term associated with it. So we'll use the terms, but then we'll tell you what they mean. So the first one you think of is perhaps authentication. Mm-hmm. And that means being able to prove that somebody who's trying to use your system is who they say they are.
Right.
So if you translate that into the real world, you might, for example, be asked to show your passport or driving license to prove you are also the owner of a credit card. And a similar concept applies when you're going to use messaging, is you've got a user ID or a certificate that identifies the entity that wants to use the messaging system, and that helps you to prove, the SSL certificate, for example, would help you to prove they were a valid user for this system.
Okay, so in terms as I'd understand it then, you really are authenticating that who the user is exactly who they say they are, and that those people are also entitled to perform whatever action on that message that they are trying to do.
Well, that's a very nice link into the next section actually, John, because the next section is called authorization. And authorization is that second half of what you just said. It's the, are they allowed to do certain actions?
Right.
So you tend to set up who's allowed to do what based on a user ID. But if you can't prove that user ID to start with, then that's not going to be any use to you to say, well, Bob can do this action, and this guy says he's Bob, so we'll let him do the action. But you haven't proved he's Bob. So authorization ties straight into the user ID that we've done with authentication. So the two tend to go hand in hand. There's no point in having authorization if you haven't done authentication.
Right, so authentication is all about identifying who the user really is.
Yeah, proof that he is who he is.
Yeah,
yes.
Proof that he's actually who he's meant to be, if that makes sense. And then authorization is to then determine what he can actually do.
Exactly.
Awesome. Okay, Morag, that sounds fantastic. So apart from authentication and authorization, what else is there?
Okay, so probably authentication and authorization are the sort of minimum subset you look at. But there are also features such as auditing, which come into a security remit, so that you can tell who's been doing what. So MQ has a lot of that, we'll talk about later. Then you might be worried about things like people snooping, people trying to peek at your data,
okay.
Because it's a very private piece of information. So then you might think about things like encryption.
Right.
Okay, so that only the appropriate people that are allowed to look at that data can actually successfully decrypt it. You might also worry about tampering of your data. And then there are security features such as digital signatures and MAC codes that help you to detect tampering and thus reject flows or messages that have been indicated to have been tampered with. So those are the other security features that you think about when you think about security and messaging.
That sounds fantastic. Do they translate well into Webs4MQ?
Surprisingly, since I knew we were going to talk about Webs4MQ, we've kind of told you about the security features in a good way to lead straight on to that, John, so I make no apologies. So authentication in MQ, we rely on the OS to authenticate you when you are running an application co-hosted with the queue manager, so locally bound as we talk about it. If you're a remote application and you're connecting in as a client, so an application over the network, then authentication is something that you can do either with security exits or with SSL certificates, allowing them to be able to authenticate you.
Okay, so if I understand it correctly, we've got two levels here. There's the kind of local security for accessing components or artifacts locally, and then there's this other aspect, which is kind of somebody remotely trying to access artifacts. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's okay. Right. Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah, the word client tends to get used to mean a lot of things. In the MQ world, client tends to mean this remote or network-attached application. So having authenticated your user that wants to make use of your MQ resources, then you're probably looking at authorizing them to do certain things. And authorization is done on the user ID in question. Now, sometimes, especially if it's a remote connection, you might actually want to use a different user ID than the client was using. The reason for this is because the client box is a machine perhaps outside of your sphere of influence, outside of your sphere of control.
Right.
You can't dictate the user ID he's going to use, and therefore you don't trust the user ID he's going to use. So actually, he comes in, perhaps using an SSL certificate, you authenticate his SSL certificate, and then you assign him a user to use on your server. Say, this guy has come in, has connected to my system, and I'm going to assign him this user ID on my system. And it might be a user ID that you set up for a number of clients because they all need the same resources to use. And you can do that either, again, through a security exit or using the channel authentication records that were added new in 7.1 to tie together your authentication method with your access control, your authorization. So access control is another word we sometimes use for authorization.
Right, okay, fair enough. That's grand, Morag. That's a really nice introduction to security of messaging, and also a nice way of dropping down into Web4MQ and what it really means in terms of somebody wanting to get to grips with security in Web4MQ. Right. So are there any other concepts and ideas that will translate into MQ for security?
Yes, yeah, so we mentioned authentication already, and then the next one we'll look at is authorization. So we talked about how you'd map your user ID to tie together authentication and authorization. So the authorization is done in MQ by means of access control lists. And these access control lists exist for each different resource. For example, a queue will have an access control list. And on that access control list, you can indicate a user is allowed to do a particular operation. So Bob can put to this queue, or Alice can get from this queue, or this administrator can delete this queue.
Okay, right.
So you have the various different operations, be they administrative operations or be they application operations. They all have access control or authorities that you can set up. So you can define who's allowed to do any particular operation to any particular MQ resource.
Okay, so we've got authentication determining who the user is, and then we've got levels of access control. So particular users may have more access as artifacts and ability to change, browse, put, get those artifacts depending on the access control list now it's been set up.
Yeah. And then we move on to looking at auditing was the next one we mentioned. So MQ has various audit records which are all written as event messages. So event messages are a particular format of an MQ message known as a PCF format.
Ah.
And all our event messages are written in this particular format. And we supply audit records for commands that have been issued. So if you said define queue, then you can have an audit record that shows the user that did this, the interface that they used, was it PCF, MQC, for example, when they created this queue, the
nice.
Time they did it, you know, the queue manager they did it on, and so on. Also, we have audit records for configuration changes. So, of course, configuration changes are all covered by commands as well, but the configuration change not just shows you the command, it shows you the entire before image and after image. So if I did an alter of a queue object, I would get the image of the queue before the alter had happened as an event and the image of the queue after the object had been changed.
Okay.
So you can have a complete audit trail of the changes you'd made and also the command that was issued as well, so you could see the actual command that was done.
Wow. That sounds really impressive. So effectively, you've got a way of tracking changes to those artifacts and the users that's done them.
Yes.
So how would you get hold of that auditing log?
So, as I said, they're written to queues. You can turn these features on and off. So you make your own decision whether you want to have these auditing records, because if you're not, if you don't need the information, there's no point in it being captured.
Right.
So you turn them on using the alter queue manager command. There's a command event and a config event switch, and you enable each one. And then these messages will be written to system.admin. something.q, where the something will be config EV or command EV to give you the queue names. You would then have a monitoring application of some sort that would read the messages as they arrive from that queue and do whatever it needs to do with them. So it might be to log them to a file, it might be to keep track of a baseline, so updating scripts to match. You could do all sorts of things with it. You have all the data there as a message on an MQ system queue. So the other things we mentioned were encryption and tamper proofing. So we have facilities for those for our channels. Our channels are our network links.
Right.
Because that's perhaps where you are most exposed to people snooping, is across the network, especially across the internet.
Sure.
Where you haven't got your own physical security. It's not your network that you're looking after. It's a more public one. So you can use SSL or TLS, transport level security, with digital certificates so that your channels have encryption on them, and they also at that point do digital signatures of all the messages to detect whether anybody has been tampering with the data as it goes across the internet.
Okay.
Now this tampering might be due to some malicious hacker, or it might be due to a hardware error in a router or something. So in either case, this kind of thing can be detected, and your flows of data across your MQ channels is able to tell if such a thing has happened. We also have encryption and tamper-proofing abilities in our AMS facility, which is our Advanced Message Security facility, which allows you to do encryption of data even while it is not flowing across the network. So while it is sitting on a queue, waiting to be retrieved by another application, as well as while it's moving across between queue managers, then it could be encrypted all the way through from end to end, as we say.
Oh, I see. So the difference then is that SSL is applied to the channels. Mm. So if I've got a queue manager which is running a machine in, say, London, and a queue manager running on a machine in New York, and I use channels to allow those queue managers to communicate, SSL will be applied to those channels to ensure that those messages are not going to be tampered with, and the message that arrives in New York is the one that was sent from London. And AMS is a kind of a stage further, where if messages are arrest on queues, they're also encrypted as well.
Yes, that's right. So, I mean, some people say that some of the security breaches happen internally, not just externally. It's not the big bag outside world. Sometimes it's inside you have to worry about too. So if you have concerns not just about the between queue managers, but also the people who have access to the data while it's at the queue manager, then you can have that encryption in a more broader sense, all the way from the original putting application before it even sort of enters the MQ network, right the way through until it is retrieved by the final getter, who's the only person allowed to get that message, because he's the only one who can decrypt that message, and then he can see the message, and all the way through the queues that it rests on in between, the channels that it goes across in between, it's encrypted all the way through.
That sounds grand. That sounds, I was about to say, it sounds like a really neat end-to-end solution. that's great. Thank you very much. So are there any other concepts that we want to...
We've covered all the ones we mentioned.
Brilliant. So in that case then, so we've got the concepts and we've got the ideas of what security is in terms of messaging. We've kind of translated them into what it means for Web3MQ. So now let's say that I'm a user who wants to start applying security to a queue or a queue manager they've already got. What sort of planning activities would they need to keep in mind when approaching security?
Okay. The easiest way to approach security is, I would say, with a decent naming convention. Now, it very much depends whether you are starting a new MQ system and you're thinking about security up front, or whether you already have an existing system that has no security on it and you have to apply security to it. The latter will require a bit more thought. If you have ended up with a good naming convention that says this set of resources named, starting with, I don't know, application group 1, all have a similar access criteria, so the same set of users can be grouped together and given access to resources that are named beginning at group 1, something.
Right.
That makes applying security to those resources much simpler. If your naming convention is a little higgledy-piggledy,
right,
then you end up having to define more rules to say who can do what, who's allowed to do this, who's allowed to do that. So you can group together these rules that say this set of users can access this set of resources with a single profile. So if you have, let's say you had three or four queues and the same access control was needed in all those queues, you could do that with a single rule, with a wildcard in it.
Ah, I see. So if those queues are called something fairly sensible, like, let's say...
Sales,
that's it.
Sales.input.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sales.input. And then whatever else after that, which would make it unique, you can apply that rule to sales.input and then have a wildcard for the rest, if all those queues need the same kind of level of security applied to them.
Yeah.
But I think what you're saying is, if I created queues which are called sales.input, one was called Jim, and the other one was called Eric, and was called invoicing, I would need lots of those.
You need
rules
to then name them specifically.
Understood.
Which makes it a bit more of an onerous task. But I think when planning security, you want to plan each of the steps. How am I going to do authentication? What is my business requirement? Am I happy with, for example, just user ID password? Is that strong enough for what I'm doing? Do I need to go to the length of having SSL certificates because I need a really strong authentication mechanism? So you need to make a decision about what level of security you need for your authentication.
Right.
Who you're going to let in, who's not allowed to be let in. You need to plan the user IDs you're going to use. If you have a heterogeneous system where you have lots of different machines, they all have their own user IDs known to the OS, you're going to have to plan which user IDs are going to be used by systems as they connect into you, applications as they connect into you, rather than trying to replicate everybody's user ID from every possible system onto your MQ system. Perhaps you should have a mapping layer there in order to say, well, when these client boxes come in, actually I'll map them down to this particular user ID.
Keep it
simpler on the MQ server box. You might then also want to plan whether you're going to do auditing. Clearly there's no point in turning audit records on if nothing is reading them. So, you know, if you do have a requirement to have an audit trail of what's going on, then you need to plan how you're going to capture that, who's going to read the messages off the queues, what are they going to do with them. And then you need to think about your message data, your content. How important is it, the privacy of this data? Is it only important as it goes across the network, or do you need to have it secured and encrypted at all times?
Nice.
And this, again, is a decision you make based on your business data. You take the comparison, perhaps, of a financial transaction that's dealing with millions of dollars versus something you might think is innocuous, like a bus timetable. Okay,
yeah.
One you might consider requires encryption, another you would say, well, it's public domain, so I don't need to encrypt it. However, I still need to secure it. I don't want somebody going in and deleting all my bus timetables so nobody knows when the buses are arriving.
Okay.
So there are clearly levels of how much security you need. And which of the facilities you choose to use will depend on how much security and what risks you're trying to avert.
Brilliant. Okay, that sounds pretty comprehensive. So if we take a step down then, so we've looked at the things that we'd need to plan for in terms of security for MQ. Is it possible to walk through a very simple scenario of applying security to, say, a very rudimentary point-to-point topology, say two queue managers joined with a couple of queues joined together with channels, for example?
Okay. There are, of course, many different decisions we need to make with such a scenario, but let's assume we have a locally bound app connecting to queue manager 1. We're going to rely on the OS for the authentication there. He's locally bound. The user has logged on to that OS to run the application. So we know we have proof of our user ID. We've defined our queue, our target queue. It's actually a remote queue.
Yep.
So we've probably got a queue remote definition, let's assume, for the simplest case. Our application says put to the name of the queue remote. So put to target.queue.
Brilliant.
Not following a great naming convention. Let's change that. Okay, the user is going to put to a queue called sales queue.
Great.
Sales.queue. And that's a queue remote defined, and it'll target a transmission queue and ultimately get picked up by a channel. But we'll have an access control rule that says our user, let's call him Bob, is allowed to put to the queue call sales.queue. So we'll put in that rule using either setmq aut commands on the distributed platforms, or also we now have runmqc versions of that, set authrec, or if you were on ZOS, then you would have a RACF profile that you had defined. But all of them serve the same purpose. They all say that Bob is allowed to do the put operation to the queue called sales.queue.
Interesting. So even though even though the messages are being sent to a remote queue, rather than simply just protecting that remote queue at source, we're ensuring that somebody can't actually use our remote queue definition to send it in the first place.
Yeah, so we can do level of security at both ends.
Okay.
The next thing we'll have is a channel definition. So we've got remote queue pointed to a transmission queue, and we've got a channel there. Let's assume that the channel was triggered and starts running when work shows up for it. It's a common pattern. If this channel is going between two queue managers that don't have good physical and network security on them, we might have decided we'd put SSL on this channel. So in order to do that, we'll have to create a digital certificate for each queue manager.
Right.
So queue manager 1 and queue manager 2 both have a digital certificate. Let's assume that we have created those and we have signed those digital certificates by a certificate authority we're using for our whole business.
Okay.
We then make sure that each queue manager has a certificate authority certificate and its own certificate in their key repository. That's the holding place for certificates the queue manager will use. As long as it has its own certificate, then it can send that to say, here's how I identify myself. And as long as it has the CA certificate, then it's able to say, I can verify anybody that was signed by that CA certificate. Queue manager 2, in this case, will have been signed by that CA certificate.
Fair enough.
So we got these certificates in place. When we define our channel, we make sure that we say SSL CIFH has a value in it. And choose a modern-day cipher spec that has not yet been subject to brute force cracking. It's like some of the older algorithms are now a bit too weak to trust. We will also indicate where this key repository holding our certificates exists. So that's a field on AltaQueue Manager.
Okay.
And we might also add some SSL peer filtering to ensure that only the expected queue manager is allowed to connect in across this channel in case somebody tries to point another queue manager erroneously or maliciously at our queue manager too.
Oh, I see.
So okay. We say we're only expecting this guy to come in. We can either do that if you're on a version earlier than 7.1 by using the channel field SSL peer, where we can put in a single filter. Or we can use the channel auth records that were introduced in 7.1 to set up a number of rules so that you can have a number of distinct filters. So a number of different queue managers could be allowed with very distinct SSL peer values, the distinguished name and a certificate. So
okay.
My distinguished name would look something like common name equals Morag, location equals Hursley, state equals Hampshire, etc. So it has a format, something like that. So you can write filters based on that format to say who's allowed to connect into this particular system.
Oh, I see. That's
so
interesting.
So Queue Manager 2 might have a rule that said that the common name equals QM1, location equals Hursley is allowed to connect in, but anybody else that isn't on that set is not allowed to connect in.
Right, I see. So let's say, for example, that our New York Queue Manager had a receive channel set up, then what we're preventing is, say, an erroneous or nasty queue manager creating a send channel with our, which would appear to be the same kind of credentials as our receive queue manager to link across, but we can say, no, we only want to allow queue managers from this location of this name to connect across to our channel and therefore send messages to our destination queue manager.
Yeah, so we can be as specific or as generic as we like in these rules. We can have rules that said any certificate that has organization equals IBM is allowed to connect in. Or you could say only certificates that are exactly like this. Common name equals Queue Manager 1, title equals Queue Manager, location equals Hursley, organization equals IBM, etc., etc., and the full specified distinguished name. So you can be quite generic or you can be quite specific in these filtering rules.
Okay, that sounds pretty flexible.
And it's more flexible now with the channel auth rules than it was with the single filter on the receiver channel definition as we used to have. So now you can set up multiple different distinct rules where you couldn't previously get them in with a wild card. Because the single filter had a wild card, so you could say, you know, common name equals QM star, and that would match QM1 and QM2 and QM3. But if you hadn't named them in a way that would work with a wildcard pattern, you were a little bit stuck. Whereas now with channel auth, you can have several different distinct rules and say, these guys are all allowed in on this channel, and by the way, we'll assign them a particular MCA user.
Oh, that makes perfect sense.
So that's probably the next bit. So we got through, we've done our applications logon, we've set up some local security. That remote queue points to a transmission queue. We've got our channel started with certificates at both ends, with SSL cipher spec on the channels, an SSL peer filtering rule on the receiver end. And what we'll also do there, because our two queue managers are very distinct operating systems, machines, and perhaps even sphere of control, or maybe even different departments or different businesses, we'll also map the allowed SSL peer name that comes in, this distinguished name we're talking about, we'll map that to a particular user ID for this receiver channel to run under.
Okay,
so we'll map that and we'll say that we trust, we know that who the party is, the queue manager one, we know who he is, we trust who he is, but on our system we'll assign him this user ID to run for that channel. Because then we can control the user IDs on Queue Manager 2 server, and we can set the rules up associated with that. So we'll say we're going to use that particular MCA user, and then we'll set up an access control list for whatever target one actually resolves to on QM2. So target queue. We'll set up a rule for what sales.queue actually resolves to on Queue Manager 2. So maybe that's sales.department.invoice or something, you know, and it's a different name. So we'll set up an access control rule as we did before for QM2, and then he can the channel can then put the message onto that target queue. So that's walkthrough of a scenario. It's very difficult to do a walkthrough of a scenario without a whiteboard, John.
I know. I must admit, keeping it all in your head is quite difficult. I must admit, but I hope I appeared like I understood. Well, that sounds grand. And so the message then travels from the key manager. We've all authenticated who it is that's going to be connecting that key manager. Put a message to that queue. We applied SSL to that channel. So we know it's not going to be tampered with midway through, and that the destination queue manager can be sure of who it is that's connecting into the destination queue manager. And we've also secured as well the destination queue, so the message can be placed on there. And we've got a good feeling, therefore, that the message, A, has come from the source it should have done, and B, hasn't been tampered or changed on the route on the way there. And then our application that's authorised at the destination end can then connect the queue manager and then do a browse and a get off that queue and then consume that message.
That's right, yeah.
Morag, that sounds fantastic. It's a really great walkthrough end-to-end of security on Web3MQ. But now you mentioned AMS a little at the beginning of the podcast. Could you tell us a bit more about it?
Okay, so AMS is a feature that, as of version 7.5, is part of the MQ installation. It used to be a separate feature that you installed separately on top of your MQ installation. Whether you get it with 7.5 or whether you got it earlier, it does the same job, however. What it does is it intercepts the puts and gets that applications do of messages. And if a profile exists to say, this queue needs to be treated as a protected queue, and by protected we mean encrypted in this case, then we'll do the encryption of the message before the message actually lands on the queue initially. So it's an interception right in the application layer, so very close to the application. In fact, when it was done in 7.1, it was done as an API exit. So that runs actually in the application process. So it will encrypt the queue, encrypt the message when you put it on the queue, and then as that message travels through the system, perhaps hopping over a number of queue managers over a number of channels, finally reaches its target destination, the authorized recipients are able to retrieve the message from the queue and actually decrypt it and see the contents. If you're not an authorized recipient, then you won't be able to retrieve the message and decrypt it. You might be able to retrieve the message by going via an alias. That's a handy way to test your encryption is working.
Yep.
It's to look at the queue via an alias queue. But you aren't able to see the decrypted content because you are not one of the authorized recipients. So you just get to see that encrypted chunk of data and you can't do anything with it.
Okay.
So that's now built in 7.5 into the base MQ. So the configuration of setting it up is a little less complex. There's no need to configure the API exit anymore. But the same process of setting up a policy to secure a particular queue, to say this queue that we're going to use needs to be encrypted. These guys are the authorized recipients. These guys are the expected signers of the message. So you say who's expected to put messages, who's expected to get them, essentially.
Okay. Fair enough. So it sounds like then we've got a method for authenticating and authorising users to use our MQ artifacts at the source, so our queue manager in the queue. We've got our channels where the message effectively flows along to its destination queue manager, and we can also encrypt and secure that. And at our destination queue manager, we can also ensure that we put the message to the queue that we are authorised to do so, and we also have a good level of confidence that whoever it is that's put that message is who we're expecting to put that message. And using AMS, while those messages are at rest on that queue, we can ensure that they are encrypted as well.
Yep, and then nobody can tamper with them or look at them until the authorised recipient comes along to retrieve it.
Morag, that sounds grand. Okay, so to finish up then, do you kind of have a final tip if there's one thing that you would stress to the user when they are planning and implementing security, what would it be?
I think my one top tip, if I had to choose one, would be to always remember to have authentication and authorization. I think a lot of people think, I've got authorization, I've got my access control lists, I've got these rules about who can do what, and therefore I'm secure. But we said at the beginning that having authorization set up without having any proof of who the users are kind of negates the security you've got. If we have operations that say Bob can do puts to this queue, but you don't ask Bob to prove who he is when he comes in, then anybody who decides to say, well, I'm Bob today, can put to that queue. So that would be my one top tip, would always ensure you have both authentication and authorization, because having one without the other is not really giving you any security.
That makes perfect sense to me. Morag, that's awesome. Thank you very much. That's brilliant.
Thank you, John.